Top 100 Project.
And action.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Top 100 Project, the weekly podcast that looks back at the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 100 greatest American movies. If you don't like spoilers and you still haven't seen this movie, then get out now. I'm Ryan Ellis, one angry man who is joined, as always, by my equally furious wife.
So mad.
Bev. Just like our dog Fox, who's always so mad.
So mad!
All right, the coming attractions trivia for 12 Angry Men. Henry Fonda's character always votes not guilty. Juror number 9, the old man, is the first to change his vote from guilty to not guilty. Who's the second man to flip-flop, and who plays him?
The gentleman from the slums, juror number 5?
That is correct.
In my notes, I think I have who plays him, but that's cheating.
Jack Klugman.
Right, Jack Klugman.
Klugman.
It's not what I said. Klugman.
Maybe you did say that.
No, I said Klugman.
Oh.
I don't know who he is, so
I think
it's irrelevant.
I read somewhere that he was the last man standing. He was the last one to live out of all these actors.
Oh, yeah. I think he mentioned something like that.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere in there, he decides to change his vote because he can relate to the defendant, I guess, and he starts seeing...
It's implied, yeah.
As most of them do, they start realizing that reasonable doubt. This movie's all about... Reasonable doubt. So the Top 100 Project's 52nd movie, 12 Angry Men, didn't make the cut on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list, although it was nominated. Then it ranked 87th in 2007 between Platoon and Bringing Up Baby. United Artists released 12 Angry Men on April 13th, 1957, after a premiere in LA a few days earlier. The low-budget flick was not a success, but was critically acclaimed. Bev's going to tell us about the movie with the skinny.
Most of the jury members deliberating on what appears to be an open-and-shut murder case think they have an easy verdict. Cool-headed Henry Fonda is juror number 8, the lone holdout for a vote of not guilty. He discusses the evidence with the other men in the overheated jury room. Tempers flare. Can he change 11 minds?
Or in a nutshell, possibly a patricidal teenager saved from electrocution by stubborn architect. We later learn that's what he is an architect with... How many kids? He says it.
Oh, gosh, I don't remember that at all.
Someone asks him if he has any kids. He says, 3.
Oh. They don't reveal very many details about the jurors at all.
It's true. We never even learn their names.
No.
They never use the names
until
of any
the very
of the...
end. Two of them introduced.
Right. Yeah. And another trivia question. What are their two last names?
I can't. Stop it.
Fonda's is easy. It's Davis.
It's so easy.
And the old man is McCardle. I like how at the very end of the movie they exchange names and then, see ya.
And then that's it. Have a nice life.
Let's not exchange phone numbers. We'll never see each other again. Even though you, old man, saved this kid from being killed because, of course, Fonda says at one point, if you all still think that this kid's guilty,
that's
after we've
true.
Been talking for about 10, 15 minutes, then I won't be in the way. But then the
Although
old man saves it.
Although his initial holding out is definitely what saves the kid's life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's the reason the kid survived more than any other one person.
And then because he was brave, juror number 9 could be brave.
Yeah. All right. We've talked about it a lot already, but what did you think of the film?
I loved this movie. It was really good. It's smart, quick, tight as a drum. It feels really realistic, even though in actuality it's phony and exaggerated kind of allegory of jury trials. It feels incredibly modern. It treats its audience with tremendous respect. And of the things to love about this film, perhaps my favorite is the way in 95 minutes it manages to fully draw 12 individual characters and believably integrate their personalities into this conflict. It's like a real feat of writing, acting, and filmmaking.
Yeah, despite the fact that Henry Fonda was a big star and he'd been on Broadway for a long time, he was sort of blacklisted.
Oh,
not
is that
the
right?
Same, not the same way that we talked about other people that were literally blacklisted.
He was legal. Graylisted, as they say?
I wouldn't say it was quite even to that point.
Mm-hmm.
But he sort of bailed on Hollywood for a little while and wasn't as active as he had been. He made movies that mattered to him more. He made Mr. Roberts that he'd been on stage and, of course, made this film.
Which he produced. He helped get it made.
The only movie he ever produced, in fact.
And he said after this he would never do it again.
But even though he's the big star, I wouldn't say he dominates the movie. They really do share center stage pretty equally.
Yeah, and each actor really has a chance to shine. I mean, a couple, you don't see too much of them.
The ones we get the least of would be juror number 2. That's John Fiedler, the bank clerk. The high-pitched voice. He was in a lot of movies, a character actor from that time.
In the early part of the film, though, he seems to have a bigger role because...
Mm-hmm. He has his moments. I just mean he's just less important in... I would say the grand scheme.
I guess so. But
same
even
with the
saying
guy.
That, then that's like a testament to how each of them got a chance to shine.
The other two, I think, are the least impressive. Not that any of them are bad in this film, but Edward Binns, who plays, I think he's supposed to be a painter. He's the brawny guy sitting beside Jack Klugman, and between Jack Klugman and Jack Warden. He's juror number 6. And then the third one, I would say, stands out maybe the least. Actually, two others I'm going to mention. One would be number 12, the executive, who's always making his silly jokes, Robert Weber.
Oh, isn't he in advertising?
That's what it is, yes.
And he's just persistently taking his glasses off and putting them back on. That's like his big business. He just can't stop doing it.
It's and the fourth least valuable member would be somebody who became a fairly well-known character actor coming out of this film and all through the 60s and beyond, Martin Balsam, who plays the jury foreman.
And who is he?
Well, we saw him briefly in On the Waterfront. It was a cameo-type performance in that. And we're going to see him in Psycho. He's the detective.
Oh, okay.
He's also in All the President's Men with Jack Warden, who's sure number seven. And he's in both the Cape Fear movies. No, they're not AFI films. But the key members would be Fonda, the old man sitting beside him, Lee J. Cobb, obviously, who's the antagonist.
The juror number three.
Yeah. E.G. Marshall, who plays the Wall Street guy, who's juror number four. And to a certain extent, Jack Warden, who's juror number seven, sitting beside Fonda. It's like Moose from Archie Comics.
But he's probably representative of a lot of people who end up on juries, too.
Yeah, yeah, very ordinary fellow. So the coming attractions trivia for Rear Window a few weeks ago was that it was a bottle episode. Here is the other one. We talked about it, of course, because that was the next one that was upcoming. We spend 93 minutes inside the jury room and 3 minutes anywhere else. Very briefly, in the opening, you see the camera winding through the courthouse. You see somebody celebrating that they've probably been acquitted.
A nice bit of foreshadowing there.
Yeah, and at the very end on the courthouse steps, we see everybody. And as I pointed out to you, the very last character we see coming out of there and very slowly walking down the stairs is Lee J. Cobb after his breakdown, what would have been not long before, maybe an hour before, or even less. We said a minute ago we don't find out any of their names until the very end. We do find out their last names, Fonda's and Joseph Sweeney, the old man. We never learn anyone else's name, though. We don't even learn anybody involved in the trial. The kid's name is never mentioned.
No, these
the witnesses are just referred to as the woman and the old man.
Yeah, even one of the issues is the defendant's race and where he's from, but they never really specify. I read somewhere that he's meant to be Puerto Rican, but I don't remember them ever saying that he's Puerto Rican.
No. It's and always these even, people. The racist guy goes, these people. You know what they're like.
And even the actor who played him, he looked intentionally vague. He could have passed for Puerto Rican, Jewish, Arab, or Italian. Like, he could have passed for any number of different cultures.
He looked a little like Sal Mineo, I would
say. He was young. He was so young.
He's supposed to be how old?
18.
18 years old,
like, just old enough to get the death penalty. Although, in the States, I believe they do try to push the death penalty on plenty of minors under 18.
They do now. Well, there's something right there. The way that the court system has changed. This movie is all about justice. And justice seems to have been served. Although, we don't know for sure at the end if he really did do it. It seems very logical that he couldn't have done this. There's way too much reasonable doubt. But then again, why would someone use the same knife that this boy owned to kill this father? After the boy had said, I'm going to kill you, and there's all kinds of motives, he was slapped around. He has a reason to want to hurt somebody. Maybe not to kill, but he has a reason to be angry at his dad at the very least. But the court system has changed so much. Now we know Guantanamo Bay, these are not citizens, and not even Americans in both cases. Here's a movie that many people revere. This movie is 8th on the IMDb's 250. Now that's not the most prestigious poll that's ever been done, because anybody can ballot box stuff that thing. Shawshank Redemption has been number 1 or 2 for so long. But most of the movies that are on that list, at least the top part of that list, the top 10 or 20, are good titles. They're not pieces of crap. This movie is in the top 10.
It's very popular.
And it's not that popular on the AFI list. As I said, 87th. And
didn't make the first surprised list. It's not higher.
But this movie is about things that, I don't want to say that people don't care about them, but it seems as if justice is not served the same kind of way anymore. We know that people with money can buy their way out of things. We know that things can be tampered with. Now, there's other things like fingerprinting that's come into play in the last 60 or 70 years.
And, of course, DNA evidence. Yeah. But do you really think this is a testament that's positive about the American justice system?
Because I think it's supposed to be.
To me, it's this boy was rescued from the American justice system. Because if...
Given a crappy lawyer.
Yeah, if juror number 8 had not been there, he essentially acts as his lawyer. He says, this boy had a terrible lawyer, he had a public defendant who clearly didn't want to be there. It's a case that's hard to win. He doesn't have the time. He just didn't bother. He didn't really cross-examine the witnesses. I found this interesting little bit about how Sonia Sotomayor loved this movie, and she said that it was the reason why she decided to go into law when she was an undergrad. But even though she loved the movie and she credits it with her career choice, she would instruct juries when she was a lower court judge to not behave the way the jurors behave in this movie, because it would actually lead to a mistrial if they tried to introduce new evidence, like the second knife that juror number 8 brings out. The assumption that the neighbor woman wore glasses would never be allowed in a real court. So in a way, what that movie's doing is not a realistic portrayal of how a jury would behave, but it's an indictment on the flaws of the justice system, that all it takes is one crummy, overworked public defender to possibly end a boy's life, an 18-year-old boy's life, is in the hands of this court that's so flawed. These characters, these jury members, through the course of the film, this tight 95-minute film, they each slowly reveal their character locked in that room. They're guilty of weakness, stupidity, blind spots, stubbornness, prejudice, racism, pride, racism.
Abject racism.
Yeah, and even malleability. Juror number 7 is just like, I'll vote how everybody votes. I would say it's more an indictment of the justice system than a celebration of it. Celebration of characters like juror number 8, who sticks up, even though...
Hollywood liberal, saving the day.
Yeah, totally.
In his white suit.
Yeah.
Defendant of justice and liberty. If he was wearing a cape and some red underwear, he could be some other very famous defender of justice. That's an interesting point of view. I don't know if I agree with the point of view. I respect the Supreme Court Justice Sotomayor.
Yes.
If I said her name correctly. But I think that the movie is saying it's all about reasonable doubt. We can't send somebody off to die on spurious evidence. You mentioned the woman's eyesight.
Mm-hmm.
Lee J. Cobb even says, how do you know? Maybe she was farsighted.
Yeah.
And he makes a good point, of course. But then as Fonda responds, I only know her eyesight's in question now.
Yeah.
And that is the whole point. Probably the strongest piece of reenactment, and this is maybe what Sotomayor and you're saying, if I may speak for the two of you, is what is not
you
realistic.
You may speak first, Sotomayor. Please, go ahead.
But anyway, when they do the reenactment, which is a bit of a fantasy of the old man shuffling down. He says he's laying in his bed and he manages to get to his front door in, what was it, 15 seconds or something. And it ends up being, according to the John Fiedler character, 3 times that long.
Yeah.
So it's more about the speed of him getting the front doors in question now.
Although I even kind of found that whole reenactment strange because they were making all these assumptions about how long it would take the murderer to get down the stairs and how long it took the murderer to even get his act together and decide to leave the apartment. Timing the scream and how long it took him to get
Well, that's because they said, the old man said it took him 15 seconds to get to the door and see the kid running down there.
Yeah, but I would mistrust somebody's sense of how much time has passed in an event like that much more than I would mistrust.
Well, yeah, but you're testifying in open court. Everyone in open court is supposed to be telling the truth. Now, we know from many other jury-type movies, including by the director Sidney Lumet, who did a lot of movies about justice, that people lie on the stand all the time, in movies at least, and probably in reality. But the assumption is supposed to be that people are telling the truth. So if the old man says, I got there in 15 seconds, then the jury and the court, the judge, everyone
has
to believe.
They are meant to take that as gospel, yeah.
But as for the man who suffered the stroke, the neighbor, and the woman across the way who supposedly saw the killing, it's interesting that the juror number 9 is the one who notices these two issues, that he's the one that talks about, why would the old man lie? For attention. He wants to be quoted. I mean, that's a little spurious, but he's the one that comes up with that
theory. He would be the one who'd be empathetic.
Because he can relate to
that. Yeah.
He's basically talking about himself. And then he's the one that notices that juror number 4 has the marks on his nose, and everyone else says, yeah, she did have those marks. And then, as Fonda says, her eyes sits in question. Juror number 4 would probably not have been convinced had it not been for that moment.
Yeah.
And he is the most rational of the ones who are for conviction for the longest time.
Yeah. Juror number 8, Henry Fonda, is probably the one who is the most mistrustful of the authority of the court enough to insist that they deliberate the case for a while before just sending this man to the electric chair. But juror number 9 is the one who kind of has the wisdom and the insight to get to the bottom of each detail.
He's the best judge of character.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the juror, I would say.
Which I guess, you know, stands to reason. He's an older gentleman. He's been on the planet longer.
I think he's the only one we don't find out what he does for a living. Everyone else, I think, at some point or another reveals what they do.
Yeah.
But not him.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's retired. He looks like he probably
would
be.
Yeah, he probably would. We may argue about whether or not it supports the American justice system, but I think I can definitely agree with you that it's upholding the ideals of the American justice system, even if it's criticizing the machinations of the American justice system.
But there are two speeches in the film that are a little too on the nose. Fonda talking about every person in this country is given a trial by peers or whatever he says. And then juror number 11, the foreign fellow who comes over.
About the American
justice. One thing I love about this country. They send you a piece of paper and you come in and a person we've never met and you have to determine whether or not they're innocent or guilty. There's nothing wrong with those speeches, but they're the two weakest moments in the film, I think. It's a little bit too didactic. As well, it's one of those things where it reminds you of the fact that old joke, there's 12 people trying this case who couldn't get out of jury duty.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's one of the few examples in the film where Lumet doesn't give the audience credit, really spells it out for them, where in many ways it's a very...
The movie's doing what they're saying already.
Yeah, yeah. One of the great things about the movie is that he doesn't insult the intelligence of the audience, but in those cases, maybe you're like, we get it, okay.
I think Fonda's speech actually is more organic, because I believe he brings up the point right after one of the racial outbursts. So the racist guy, Ed Begley, and he has a couple different rants until at the end, he has that big one where he just goes off on a whole tangent. But even Lee J. Cobb's character, who's more about anti-young people than he is about anti-these types of people, we can't trust them. But after some of that stuff has been said, Fonda tries to calm everybody down, I think, by saying, it's hard to keep prejudice out of a thing like this. So it's more organic the way he brings it up than the other juror. But anyway, those are the moments in the film that I thought were among the weakest. One theme about the film that cannot be overlooked, though, and one of the reasons that tempers do flare, and we said about this in the opening, that it's supposed to be the hottest day of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Another AFI movie that has that theme, and the director's talked about how that influences what the people do in his movie, also set in New York, Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing.
Oh, yeah. And one of the other few low-budget films to make the list.
Yeah. The heat in that jury room, the literal heat, is obviously a factor in this whole thing. They all want to go for obvious reasons, and they all think at first that this kid's clearly guilty. So most of them who are not hate-filled people, there's only two people in this movie who are morally questionable in that way,
mm-hmm.
and it's Lee J. Cobb and it's the old racist.
Yeah.
Everyone else who votes guilty seems to just think that the prosecution made their case.
I think one of the things that the film is trying to portray is how juries will vote just because they suspect that's how everybody else is going to vote. Mm. People are less concerned about making their own minds up and more concerned about making a consensus with everybody else. And in the initial scene, when they take the vote, they don't take a secret vote. They raise their hands so that everybody can see. About half the jury members just raise their hands immediately without much thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then the others kind of slowly raise their hand. The very last one to raise their hand is juror number 9.
Yeah, the old
and
man.
He's reluctantly, we actually went back and watched this again to see if their hands were raised in the opposite order that they changed their vote. And it certainly was true, at least in juror number 9's case. And he reveals a lot of reluctance in that physical act of raising his hand. And I wonder if he had doubts, but just was too chicken to kind of go against the other jury members. But that's why he immediately kind of joined causes with juror number 8.
Yeah, well, you're the one that noticed that when the film was over. Well, let's go back to that scene, and you're right. And that, so wide shot, the camera is behind juror number 8 and 9. So you can see that right arm of the old man gingerly go up. I believe that Jack Klugman, the second one, as we said in the opening, to flip-flop, I think he's also a little reluctant as well.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, too, because we're talking about the opening at this moment with this particular scene. Lumet was a new director. This is his debut film.
Yeah.
He'd done a lot of television. Yeah. John Frankenheimer, Robert Altman, also directors, did a lot of television, live television, in fact, in the 50s and into the 60s and beyond for some of these guys. William Friedkin, I believe, is another one. All these guys had AFI films, in fact. But this was Lumet's very first movie, and he's never been known as a technical genius. But one thing he did in this film that was very interesting is that in the opening scenes, the camera is more often above. Then in the middle, it gets a little bit different. He changes lenses, he changes angles, and by the end, the camera's low. Always low.
Under their sight line.
Yeah, so they're looming over the camera all the time. And also it has this claustrophobic feeling. The walls kind of, I think the lenses are changed too.
Yeah,
so
he made longer lenses. The lenses keep getting longer and the camera keeps getting closer to the ground to increase, well, a longer lens is just going to make everything look closer together. And showing the ceiling in the shot is just a way to make the audience feel uncomfortable. And it has, like you said, the characters looming over the camera, looming over the audience to increase the claustrophobia. It really does make you uncomfortable. I think the very last shot, the camera is a wide angle. It's up again because they've resolved the issue. So it's to let the audience breathe more.
And one of the rare times music plays as well as in the closing last few minutes of the movie. But throughout the film, you could pretty much call it 12 Angry White Men.
Yeah.
And at the end, you could call it 12 Angry Close-Ups, because even though I think it's our old friend Roger Ebert talked about how the movie doesn't have a lot of close-ups at the end, if not close-ups, maybe two shots, but it's not that the camera's wide at that point. It's an awful lot of it. It's kind of that movie M. Have you ever heard of that movie?
I've heard of it.
Peter Lorre plays a child killer. I don't want to give away the movie, but I'll just say this. There's a scene in that movie where accusatory people cut to different faces, and 12 Angry Men has that kind of moment where it's just showing people's faces. In fact, two people are swayed by the silent treatment. Two of the last three who are swayed. The racist rant by Ed Begley. You know, these people, that's the way they are. I don't have anything against anybody. And then very slowly but surely people get up and walk away, or at least turn their backs to him until juror number 4 says, I've heard you. Now sit down and don't open your mouth again. And he doesn't open his mouth again. So the silent treatment shuts him up. Lee J. Cobb, the last hodo at the end, is going on his rant about how we can't let him slip through our fingers. And of course you realize, if you didn't already, that his real problem is with his son. And this kid is representing his son. Nobody's really saying anything. They're all looking at him except for the racist guy who still had his back to them this whole time. But that's where they cut to all those close-ups. So those two shots of everyone just staring at this guy who's having this breakdown. And he finally just, no, not guilty.
Yeah, I didn't really notice the camera work when we were watching it and the decisions that Lumet made with the camera, but it really is incredibly effective, and it's proof that even with a limited, relatively uninteresting space, cinematography can still make the film and have a tremendous influential impact.
Yeah, Boris Kaufman's guy did this film, the Polish
and
Boris Kaufman.
And Lumet was a cinematographer before he was a director so...
Kaufman worked on The Waterfront, so we've already seen his black and white work earlier this year in a realistic kind of way, and also set in New York. And he worked with Lumet a lot as the years went on.
Apparently the black and white was blamed for the film's poor performance in the box office.
Well, we've had a lot of big Technicolor films in the project, and there were a lot of other ones that were big hits. We said when we did Giant that it wasn't the biggest hit of that year, but it was third best. But the other two are both highly ranked on the adjusted for inflation box office list. Ten Commandments, I believe, is sixth big widescreen color movie.
Yeah.
About grand epic things. Dozens of cameras were used in that film and everything else. Everyone knows about Ten Commandments. I don't need to go on. Around the World in 80 Days is a film that's set around the world. Also big Technicolor. So yeah, 12 Angry Men is the complete opposite. It's more like television.
And it was based on a teleplay. It was actually made for television first and then adapted for the screen, which is not really something you see all that often. You see television shows get turned into movies, but for them to just directly adapt something into a film is kind of unusual. And even though it didn't do well in the theater, it kind of got a second life once it started airing on television and became, like many movies on the list actually, gained its popularity after it left the theater, or became legendary after it left the theater.
Including being eighth on the IMDb's 250 now.
Yeah,
people worldwide, obviously.
But I can see how it's a great small screen film.
So getting back to the acting and Lee J. Cobb and his breakdown at the end, what did you think of his performance in this? You weren't that impressed with him in On the Waterfront.
You said that before. I don't remember having a problem with him.
I thought you did. Maybe it wasn't in the podcast recording itself. Maybe it was just after we watched the movie for On the Waterfront.
At least. I don't remember disliking him in that movie. I liked his performance. He could have easily been over the top, and in a way he was over the top, especially his breakdown at the end.
Well, he's a roarer too. He's a big, loud,
but it
yelling
worked
actor.
For me, and I can't put my finger on why. Maybe if I saw it on a different day, I would roll my eyes and think it was melodramatic, but I really loved all the performances in this film, even though sometimes they were a little over the top and melodramatic. It worked for me.
What did you think of Fonda?
Oh, I liked him. He's definitely, you know, like you said before, he's wearing his white suit and he's on his white horse.
He likes his issues films.
Yeah.
Grapes of Wrath is only other AFI film. Yeah, it's also a big issues film.
But at least Grapes of Wrath has a little more complexity and deeper character. In 12 Angry Men, he's just kind of a bland good guy in a way. And of course, he's necessary to be that way. But he's probably the least interesting of the 12 jurors. He just incites the...
Really? You think so?
Yeah, well, because he's just a bland hero, right? Doing the right thing. I liked his performance, don't get me wrong.
And this is the last time we'll talk about him on the project.
Mm-hmm.
We tangented it off a minute ago about the justice system. I have a few more things I want to say about it. I said it was 12 Angry White Men. So there you go. The closest thing we have to a non-white man, and he still is white, is juror number 11, George Boskovec, I think is how you say his name. So he's from another country, at least. So he sort of represents the defendant better than anyone else can.
Oh, I guess juror number 5 as well, because he's from the same slums, and he has skin, I guess he could be Latino or Italian or something.
But it's men... They're white and no women, which is something that would become more common in the decades that followed. But there would have been women on juries at some point in this time in history.
Yeah, I think it would differ by state. So I'm not sure where New York fits into that.
The other AFI movie from 1957 we're going to deal with, Bridge on the River Kwai, is also man-heavy.
Not a lot of exceptions on the other side of that, eh? Not a lot of movies where there's no male characters, are there?
Bridge is about a war in World War II, so that makes sense. They're over in a whole different part of the world. But yeah, so two movies.
Yeah, Hollywood doesn't really shy away from making sausage fest movies. Just put it that way.
You've said it before on this project. You're probably going
to
say
it. Well, I'm not the first or the last person to point that out.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the cast and crew of the film. Henry Fonda is his second of two AFIers. He did Grapes of Wrath 28 AFI movies ago.
Mm-hmm.
And as we said, he's now done. He was a staunch liberal. We saw it in full effect in both of his films. And he went out on a real high note in his life and in his career because he won an Oscar for his last screen performance in On Golden Pond, which probably had an outside chance of making this list. I bet it was probably fairly highly ranked both times they voted. We've talked a lot about the supporting cast. The biggest star of those 11 would be Lee J. Cobb, his second of two AFIers after On the Waterfront, and he was also in The Exorcist, where he's a whole different kind of character. He's a very gentle, nice cop.
Mm-hmm.
Seen The Exorcist?
I have, yeah.
Okay, another movie that probably was on the outside looking in
of
this list. Had to be pretty close.
Was it ever nominated?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
Martin Balsamy plays the jury foreman. He's in On the Waterfront briefly. He's in Psycho and All the President's Men, so we get a bit more of him. I guess his biggest role would be in Psycho, even though he's a supporting character in all of these movies. Jack Klugman mostly did TV after this, including very famously The Odd Couple, where he plays the character that Walter Matthau played in the movie. And then he also did Quincy M.E. And we got Jack Warden, juror number 7, Moose from Riverdale. He worked for 50 years.
Wow.
Long career for that fella. He was also in From Here to Eternity fairly briefly. He'll also be in All the President's Men with many other big names, including, of course, Martin Balsam. And he was in movies called Shampoo and Being There in the 70s. So he had a very interesting filmography. If you've ever seen Shampoo or Being There, listeners, you should probably check both of those out. He plays the president in Being There.
Being There is the one with Peter Sellers.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Chauncey Gardner. E.G. Marshall, who I thought was very good as juror number 4, the cold but logical and fair, as it turned out, stockbroker. He also was the president of Superman 2, the one who kneels to Zod. And he was the Attorney General, John Mitchell, in Nixon quite a few years ago. And he also did many other movies. None other on the AFI list. Edward Benz. He was in 3 AFI movies. So here's the guy who played the painter at the end of the table, okay, number 6. Yeah, yeah. He was also in North by Northwest and Patton, and he also has a role in The Verdict, which is a Sidney Lumet film about the justice system yet again, one of Paul Newman's best performances. But yeah, we see Benz 3 different times, more than most of these guys have for AFI films. And he's also the one that raises the point in the washroom. What if you convince all of us that this kid didn't do it, and it turns out he let a murderer go free? Which is a very good point.
Yeah, something that actually isn't addressed all that much. What if you're not guilty, verdict is wrong?
And the other guys, Ed Begley plays racist juror number 10, his son, of course, Ed Begley Jr. Yes. Ed Begley Sr. won an Oscar in the 60s. His performance is a little racist in one note, well, a lot racist. We talked about Joseph Sweeney plays juror number 9, not a lot of big credits for him. George Voskovich, I don't know how you pronounce his name, is the foreign guy for juror number 11. And Robert Weber, at the end of the table, the glasses putting on and off guy.
So indecisive about whether or not he wants to wear his glasses.
And he's the only one, at least the only one that flip-flops more than once. Everyone else who changes their vote sticks with it. But he, well, maybe he's guilty. Maybe he's not. Maybe he is. Maybe he's not. And then John Fiedler plays juror number 2. We talked about Sidney Lumet, director with a lot of great credits, but only 2 on the AFI list. This and Network.
Yeah, when I was going through his credits, I'd never put together that he directed all those films. Dog Day Afternoon.
That's the one of all that didn't make the list I think probably should have of his credits.
Yeah. I like Dog Day
Afternoon. If I had to name 5 or 10 movies by anybody that didn't make this list that really should have, Dog Day Afternoon is somewhere in that top 5 or 10.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a while, but it is a really good movie.
Lumet's next film is Network, and that's 42 AFI movies away, mid-70s. And this guy worked for a long time. He only died a few years ago. His last movie, very good way to go out, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, with a guy we've mentioned a little bit this year who died earlier this year.
Hoffman.
Philip Seymour Hoffman. Yep. And as I said, one of the best directorial debuts of all time. It's up there with Tarantino doing Reservoir Dogs or Welles doing
Another
Citizen
Bottle
Kane.
Episode just about, obviously not really, but really about...
Reservoir Dogs?
Reservoir Dogs, yeah. It's about
mostly
like
in that warehouse.
Conflict of people stuck in a situation in one room.
And then Sam Mendes, another guy I would like to mention who had a great debut with American Beauty. And there are other big names too. Mike Nichols, his first film was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Oh, he was a theater director, wasn't he?
I think he may have been. Yeah. We're going to get to him. In the 60s. One thing about Lumet, we talked about his technical expertise, or I wouldn't say lack thereof, but not a Spielberg, Hitchcock, Ford kind of person who used the camera so obviously well and called attention to himself that way. Coppola with Apocalypse Now is another one. What he did, though, that was notable for his actors, he rehearsed for weeks, and that would be part of the filming schedule, and then they'd shoot quickly and efficiently, which they certainly did in this film. They would actually shoot as many scenes as they could from one angle of somebody and then get to the other side of that conversation later. So conversations would be really broken up. We've heard about this in movies before, but you wouldn't think in a movie like this where you've got one small set that you need to do that. But they did in this case. They would shoot, say, Lee J. Cobb scenes. Maybe not all of them back to back to back, but they shoot a lot of his scenes and then later on get to Fonda's reactions sometime later.
Yeah. His gift, or at least the true gem of this film, is their performances. And also that script is, the storytelling of it is so intelligent and intricate and tight. There's really no waste in it, and it's really beautifully done. I think that's something that's underrated in directors, is just the ability to efficiently tell a story in a way that doesn't really show the strings of the puppeteer. And
most directors said they don't want you to notice, that score was great, that editing was incredible. The cinematography, if you're talking about it as a viewer, I mean, we're supposed to break these things down for what we're doing. But if you come out of there and you're talking about that with your friends when you've come out of the movie that night, that's probably a failure in the eyes of most directors.
Well, I mean, I think there's exceptions. Martin Scorsese with his freeze frames, he's calling attention to himself, and it's certainly a stylistic thing, but I wouldn't call that a fail. Yes, it's flair. He's definitely showing off to some extent, but if that's his style and it works with the film, then I don't fault it. I would disagree with somebody.
Well, there you go. That's a good point. I don't want to waffle on what I just said, because I'm not the one saying that.
You're juror number
12?
12-ing right now. Take your glasses off, sir.
I can't see my computer from my notes if I do that. But what I mean is, other people have said this. I've heard a lot of commentaries. Well, directors will talk about that. You shouldn't be noticing all these aspects of the film. But directors and actors and everybody involved in the movie-making business have to do them their own way. Recently, Grand Budapest Hotel came out, Wes Anderson movie, and he was criticized, as he always is, for his style, the twee and all the way that people criticize him. But that's what he does. Tarantino does what he does. Scorsese does what he does. Lumet did what he did. Directors need to be who they are.
Yeah.
And if somebody doesn't like it, then don't watch their films, is what it has to come down to. But I do think that Lametta is one of those people that would have agreed with that point, which is you shouldn't be seeing the string.
And there's a value in that as well. And yeah. I think he does an absolutely exceptional job with this film. You really don't see the strings. Yeah. It's just nearly perfect in the way it's executed.
And nice and short, too. We're in the midst of a lot of long movies, which will have moments where you're probably going to say, I was bored.
Oh, yeah. I'm prepared for some boredom. But this I've movie seen Ben Hur before, and oh, my God.
And parts of Vertigo, but I don't think you can say that about this film.
Oh, no.
If you were bored by it, then you didn't like any of it.
It was really engaging,
yeah.
But never phony. It was very engaging.
The writer of the film, Reginald Rose, you mentioned it was his own teleplay that was adapted, and he wrote for TV for quite a while and then went back to writing movies. Nothing really of note beyond this one.
He was one of the producers as well, too.
Yep, right? He and Fonda, the only movie that either of them ever produced was this one. And they were nominated for Best Picture. Obviously, they didn't win. But as you said, Fonda didn't ever want to produce a movie again. He couldn't watch himself on screen either. I read that somewhere. He had a hard time watching himself. And that was part of the reason why he didn't want to produce, because he knew he had to be in there for dailies. Funny that a guy who was so naturalistic and believable couldn't watch himself on screen. So the tech guys, I talked about Boris Kaufman, who shot the film. The editor was Carl Lerner. He did The Fugitive Kind for Lumet and Clute. We're not going to cover either one of those films, but they're definitely noteworthy titles. Clute was Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland. And the composer was Kenyon Hopkins, who would later do The Hustler. And for once, a music score, subtle and barely there.
Yeah, the way I like it.
And that seems appropriate for the conversation we just had about minimalism, the way that Lumet obviously liked to do things. When you talk about influence, you could probably mention a whole lot of them. Maybe the most important one is that a current Supreme Court justice is influenced by this film. The other influence would obviously be the TV movie they made in 1997 with Jack Lemmon and George C. Scott. And that was the Emmys or the Golden Globes, where Ving Rhames, who won an award that night for playing, I believe it was Don King, gave his award to Jack Lemmon because he disrespected him so much. And it was for Lemmon's work in the 12 Angry Men TV movie, directed by William Friedkin. Yeah. Lemmon in the Fonda role, George C. Scott in the Lee J. Cobb role. And interesting, Scott followed Cobb in a few performances. I mentioned The Exorcist earlier, where Cobb played Kinderman. Well, in the 1990 sequel, George C. Scott played Kinderman because Cobb had died in the interim.
Mm-hmm.
And Lemon had acted with Fonda in Mr. Roberts, where Lemon won Supporting Actor Oscar. Look at all these connections. All right, so the awards and other AFI list is pretty extensive. 3 Oscar nominations, but no wins. Picture, director, and for that screenplay. So Fonda and Lumet and Rose all went to the awards. Nobody came away with anything. They lost all 3. Our next film, Bridge on the River Kwai. 12 Angry Men made the National Film Registry in 2007. It took a long time for them to honor that movie.
Yeah, I'm really surprised.
Nearly 20 years.
It's kind of such an American film, too.
Yeah. And then quite a few AFI lists. 88th on Top 100 Thrills. 42nd Top 100 Cheers, so most inspiring. Juror number 8 was the 28th most marvelous dude on the Heroes and Villains list. And it was the number 2 courtroom movie on the Top 100 genres.
I take issue with it being on the Thrills list. Just what part of that movie was thrilling?
I remember when I saw the Thrills show, they showed the clip where they're talking about how the knife went into
they
the...
Stabbed.
No one's hurt here, right? No one's hurt.
That's not... See? Not thrilling. No one got hurt.
Well, that's the answer to your question, I guess. That was the AFI's response to that. That one moment, I guess.
That's a strange one.
Yeah, it's maybe a debatable choice. Thrilling in the sense of, will he change their minds? Except, you know, you see a movie like this, it seems kind of obvious that he must.
Yeah.
Unless it's 10 minutes long and then he just caves. You guys are right. I don't want to be here any longer.
You can spoil this movie. Nobody's going to suspect that. Everybody's just going to bowl him over and vote him, either hang the jury or find him guilty and send him to the electric chair.
Seems unlikely. All right, so I think we've said enough about the film. We're both big fans. It's a nice little reversal from what we're going to get in the future with some of these huge epics. And some of them are great films, of course. But here's a movie that has a simple story, nice and quick, bang, in, out.
Yeah, that's the way I like it. You have good writing, good acting, you don't need a lot of bells and whistles.
We watched this movie on vacation, in fact. And now we're going to be going away again, and that will preempt the Top 100 Project for 1 week.
Yes, it's the anniversary, I think, of the last time we preempted.
Yep, both times because, well, last year we got married and we were away.
And we were on our honeymoon
and now we're going to be going away just coincidentally.
Celebrating our first anniversary, so... This is the 1 week a year when I'm sorry you will not have a Top 100 Project to enjoy, but just 1 week off.
We're one of the few podcasts that I ever listen to that doesn't ever seem to take any time off.
We work hard.
We earn
for you, our listeners. You're welcome.
But we'll be back on May 19th with a review of David Lean's first of 3 AFI epics, and all these feature the terrific Alec Guinness. And this one is Bridge on the River Kwai, a movie you've never seen.
Yeah, one that I've been looking forward to.
So the coming attraction trivia for Bridge on the River Kwai. I mentioned that Alec Guinness is in this. He was in 4 AFI films in the Top 100. What's the highest military rank his 4 characters achieve?
So you can get the answer to that trivia question on May 19th on our Bridge on the River Kwai episode. And if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What did you think of 12 Angry Men? We'd love to hear what you think about this and all the other movies that we cover on the project. Please send us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
And if I may quote the old man McCardle, well, so long.
And cut.